I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer Nicole Krauss. She's joined in conversation by Judson True. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Nicole Krauss and Judson True.
So Nicole Krauss is here this evening, hailed by the New York Times as one of America's most important novelists. She's the award-winning author of Great House, a finalist for the National Book Award, the New York Times bestseller, The History of Love, and Man Walks Into a Room. Nicole was selected as one of Granta's best young American novelists in 2007 and named to the New Yorker's 20 Under 40 list in 2010. Forest Dark, her new novel for which she's here to discuss this evening, interweaves the stories of two disparate individuals, an older lawyer and a young novelist, whose transcendental search leads them to the same desert in Israel. Appearing in conversation with Nicole this evening is Judson True. Judson's day job is chief of staff to Assemblymember David Chu, but he moonlights here as an on-stage interviewer. He's hosted conversations on our stage with Khaled Hosseini, George Saunders, and Karen Russell, among many others. Please give them both a warm welcome to the JCC. Thanks.
Good evening, Nicole. Welcome to the JCC.
Thank you.
So great to have you here in San Francisco.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so let's jump right into the book. First of all, thank you for writing such a, I think it's a powerful and challenging novel in all the best senses of the word, and it reverberates well after you finish the last page. I think it'll be one that lasts for years that you think about here and there. So that's a,
I hope so.
It's incredible. And it does tell the story of two individuals, and they go through similar circumstances in Israel. First, coming from America, let's talk about Epstein first, and a little bit. What is he about?
Well, he Epstein. The very opening of Forest Dark begins with his disappearance in the desert, and sort of backtracks to figure out what has happened to this man. And Epstein is the kind of character that I think, you know, some of us know. Some of us know intimately. He is, or was, larger than life, a man of absolute authority and certainty, and one of these sort of extraordinary New York attorneys who just was very, very at home in the material world and with pleasure and at ease in that whole realm. And at a certain moment in his life, in the wake of his parents' deaths and leaving his marriage of many decades, he finds himself in a place that I think probably is familiar to all of us, no matter how old we are, which is that place where you think, what if I was wrong to base my life on these set of certainties? For him, there's a kind of turning toward uncertainty, turning toward that realm which he feels, in a sense, that he neglected all of his life, which you might call, for lack of a better word, the spiritual realm. And so we sort of follow as he gives away everything that he owns. He, with the last bit of his money, we follow him to Israel. He wants to do something in memory of his parents.
Why don't we set the stage with a little bit of from the book about
sure.
him, about
yeah.
from Forest Dark.
I'll read you just a little bit of what kind of man Epstein was. No one could have imagined it. And yet it came to seem like a fitting end. Death was too small for Epstein. In retrospect, not even a real possibility. In life, he had taken up the whole room. He wasn't large, only uncontainable. There was too much of him. He constantly overspilled himself. It all came pouring out, the passion, the anger, the enthusiasm, the contempt for people, and the love for all mankind. Argument was the medium in which he was raised, and he needed it to know he was alive. He fell out with 3/4 of everyone he had fallen in with. Those that remained could do no wrong. and were loved by Epstein forever. To know him was either to be crushed by him or madly inflated. One hardly recognized oneself in his descriptions. He had a long line of protégés. Epstein breathed himself into them. They became larger and larger, as did everyone he chose to love. At last, they flew like a Macy's parade balloon. But then one day they would snag themselves on Epstein's high moral branches and burst. From then on, their names were anathema. In his inflationary habits, Epstein was deeply American, but in his lack of respect for boundaries and his tribalism, he was not. He was something else, and this something else led to misunderstanding again and again.
Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about why he starts to come unmoored a little bit. What is it that starts to make him doubt the whole foundation of his life? Is there anything in particular, or is it just the buildup of the years?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know if you've watched people around you who have lost their parents, but that's not something, thank goodness, that has happened to me yet. But there is that thing that once that which made you in the world ceases to exist, you are in a kind of free fall, you know? And Epstein is one of these people who has, you know, who's had a lifelong relationship of conflict with his parents. There's deep love, but it's a kind of triangulated argument. The parents arguing with each other, arguing with him, arguing, you know. And it's that conflict that made him. He was kind of formed in opposition. And yet there's a moment in which he says, you know, my parents never taught me to be creative. You know, they taught me in that sense only to argue, to oppose. And I think in the wake of that loss, without them, in a sense, to define him in that lifelong way, he is kind of without the ballast that kept him anchored. And I also think, you know, part of what drew me to him as a character is that he has tenderness in him. Anyone who can open themselves to that possibility of, what if I were wrong, you know? I think there's something moving about that to some degree. And then the last thing I would say about him that fascinated me, that drew me to him, was, you know, there's a moment in the book, you'll remember this, but I think most people probably haven't read the book yet. Epstein, he's still in New York, and he goes to this meeting for sort of important Jews at the Plaza Hotel. And Mahmoud Abbas is there, and it's sort of a meeting about peace, you know. One of those.
You put a few other sort of well-known celebrity Jewish intellectuals and spokespeople there too to really set the scene.
Right, so
really, you can just picture that on, you know, being covered by CNN.
And he's there, and after it's over, this rabbi comes up to him, this kind of mystical rabbi who has one of these Kabbalistic schools in Sfat, and says, "Epstein, you know." That name, that's one of those famous names like Diane or Abravanel that goes all the way back to King David. And there are a few such names, and people really do believe that. They trace the lineage back to King David. And Epstein kind of scoffs and said, "Are you kidding? Epstein, that's like a shtetl name, you know?" And yet, that thought of, I go back to King David, begins slowly and subtly to shift, sort of settle into Epstein's sense of himself. And who was David? You know, who was King David? He was, according to the Book of Samuel, this cutthroat warrior, beloved by everyone, but manipulative, difficult, you know, brutal, magnetic. But according to the Jews, who also ascribed him the most beautiful poetry ever written, the Psalms, you know, he's also someone who at the end of life sort of stumbles into grace. And so in this way, Epstein's begins to kind of model, without consciously being aware of it, model his sense of himself on that road from kind of warrior through to old and lasting grace.
And he gets a book from his daughter that also has wisdom in it that he probably would have tossed aside not many years before.
Right. She's a big reader, and she gives him a book for his birthday, and sometimes he looks, sometimes he doesn't look at the book she gives. But this one he does by an Israeli poet, and he's very moved by it. And he reads it, but at that same meeting at the plaza, he has the book in his coat pocket. He carries around his coat pocket. And when he, after this meeting is over, he goes to get his coat back from the coat check, and they give him the wrong coat back. And he says, "This isn't mine. This is my coat." And he realizes that somebody from the Palestinian Party took his coat by accident. And so he goes, and he doesn't have to do this thing. Does it's scratchy, and it's not like his beautiful, you know, coat.
Yeah,
and
not as good a coat.
It's not as good a coat. And more than that, the book is gone, and so is his cell phone. And so,
I just love the idea of him calling his assistant over and over throughout the book, although he gets less and less interested as she works to try to track down the coat.
The coat kind of goes through the phone.
Yeah. And he's actually mugged in the park with the other coat. Right,
yeah.
And he loses his phone and the book,
and then his wallet is taken too, and he's already been given away, like he's given away all his beautiful art, his Matisse's, his, you know, he has nothing left hardly except for this last bit of money he's taken out on loan from credit from his apartment, and then his money is like taken too by this mugger in Central Park.
Yeah, and the mugger has a knife and says, "What's inside?" And he doesn't have anything, and he says, tellingly, he says, "Nothing,
nothing, nothing." Yeah.
But that was a really good sign of important symbol of where he was at that point in his life and what he was trying to find out. And so before we turn to the other character, why does Epstein go to Israel?
So Epstein has this idea that it was where he was born. His parents, you know, as it says in the book, his parents sort of washed up on the shores of Palestine after the war and conceived him there. And he was born in Israel, and then they go to America afterwards. And so he goes back to Israel with this longing to somehow do something in his parents' name. And he doesn't know what that is. And, of course, they give him all the normal recommendations. We'll go to the Weizmann Institute, or, you know, maybe you'll do endow the chair of the first violinist at the Israeli Philharmonic, or whatever it is. He meets Mehta. I mean, he goes through all those things, but nothing is right. Nothing is right. And in the end, he stumbles into this strange dream of planting this massive forest in a mountain in the desert in his parents' name.
Well, let's leave him in Israel for the moment and turn to the other key character in the book, whose name is Nicole. Mm. And Nicole is... Why don't you tell us who Nicole is in the book?
Yeah, so... She has my name. She has a broad strokes of my life. She's a writer. She has two sons. She lives in New York. And she begins to feel, again, I think this won't be a foreign feeling to a lot of people, she begins to feel that the forms that she's chosen for her life have grown too narrow, too constraining for her. So whether those are the roles of wife and mother or the forms of her work. She's a novelist, so the form of the novel, all of those forms which are hers to kind of operate in are no longer fit her in a sense. And she is facing the idea of what does it take, what kind of courage does it take to be formless for as long as it was required to find a better shape.
And one of the things about naming a character Nicole in the book is you're really playing with the real there. What's real, what's not real. And there's a passage in the book that illustrates her connection to the real, I think, in an incredible way. So if you wouldn't mind reading that for
us. I'll read that, sure.
Please.
So she begins to have this obsession with maybe she could get through her writer's block if she could somehow set a novel or somehow take the form of a novel from this hotel she has been going to since she was a child. It's the Hilton Hotel in Tel Aviv. It's very small here in the cover. Some of you may even know it. It sits sort of cantilevered on the shore of the Mediterranean in Tel Aviv, and it was built in the brutalist style. So it's a really imposing, grid-like building. But Nicole thinks she was probably conceived there. Her parents got married there. So it is this familiar place. But more than that, it is for her, despite its appearances, despite the way in which it seems to impose, like most architecture, seems to impose how we ought to live in it, she feels the opposite, that hotel is somehow representative of a kind of portal to otherworldliness or other worlds. And because of basically, as she describes it here, the spine-tingling nature of something that once happened to her there, an experience that only increased her awareness of an opening, a small tear in the fabric of reality. So this is that scene. It occurred in the hotel's swimming pool when I was 7. I spent a lot of time in that pool, which was set on a large terrace overlooking the sea and fed by its salt water. The year before, our visit had overlapped with Itzhak Perlman's, and one morning after breakfast, we came out and found him parked by the deep end, throwing a ball to his children, who took turns leaping into the pool, trying to catch it. The sight of the great violinist in his glinting wheelchair, along with a murky awareness that the polio that had crippled him had something to do with swimming pools, terrified me. The next day, I refused to go down to the pool altogether, and the day after that, we left Israel and flew back to New York. The following year, I returned to the hotel with a feeling of unease, but Perlman didn't reappear. Furthermore, on the first day back, my brother and I discovered that the pool was full of money. Shekels everywhere, shimmering mutely on the floor of the pool as if the drain were hooked up to Bank HaPaolim. Whatever lingering fears I had about swimming were shunted aside by the steady flow of cash we could turn up. As in any well-run operation, we soon divided and specialized. My brother, 2 years older, became the diver, and I, with a smaller lung capacity and keener eyes, became the spotter. At my direction, he would plunge down and grope around at the blurry bottom. If I had been right, as I was about 65% of the time, he would burst excitedly to the surface, clutching the coin. One afternoon, after a string of false calls, I began to feel desperate. The day was wearing on, and our time in the pool was almost up. My brother was wading morosely along the wall of the shallow end. I couldn't help myself, and from the middle of the pool shouted, "There!" I was lying. I'd seen nothing. But I couldn't resist the chance to make my brother happy again. He came splashing toward me. "Right there," I yelled. He went below. I knew there was nothing at the bottom, and now treading water at the top, I waited miserably for my brother to find out too. The crushing guilt I felt in those few moments comes vividly back even more than 30 years later. It was one thing to lie to my parents, but to so blatantly betray my brother was something else again. As for what happened next, I have no explanation for it. Or rather, none beyond the possibility that the laws we cling to in order to assure ourselves that all is as it seems have occluded a more complex view of the universe, one that forgoes the comfort of squeezing the world to fit the limited reach of our comprehension. Otherwise, how else to explain that when my brother surfaced and uncurled his fingers, lying in his palm was an earring with 3 diamonds, and beneath them, hanging from a gold loop at the bottom, a ruby heart. In dripping bathing suits, we followed our mother through the frigid, air-conditioned hallways of the hotel to the H. Stearns in the lobby. She explained the situation to the balding jeweler, who looked at us dubiously as he pushed a tray lined with blue velvet across the glass countertop. My mother laid the earring down, and the jeweler fit the loop to his eye. He studied our treasure. When he lifted his head at last, his giant, magnified eye swiveled over us. "Real," he pronounced. "The gold is 18 carat." Real. The word catches in the throat and won't go down. It never occurred to me that the earring might be fake in the way that my mother had suspected it was. And yet only I knew just how unreal it really was. How against the odds was my brother's discovery of it. How it had materialized in answer to a need. No young child naturally believes that reality is firm. To her, its springs are loose. It is open to her special pleading. But slowly she is taught to believe otherwise, and by then I was 7, old enough to have mostly come around to accepting that reality was fixed and utterly indifferent to my longings. Now, at the last minute, a foot was put in the way of a door closing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to author Nicole Krauss, whose new novel is Forest Dark. She's joined in conversation by Judson True on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so many years later, now feeling this need for freedom and feeling constrained in her life, Nicole goes back to Israel, leaves her family, leaves her marriage, which is under strain, and her young children. And what is she really looking for when she gets there?
Well, you know, she doesn't know, in a sense, what she's looking for. I think she is, you know, she goes ostensibly to do research in this hotel. But the first thing that happens to her, really, is she gets this invitation from her father's cousin, who has a friend who may or may not be former Mossad, or may or may not be a retired professor of literature from Tel Aviv University. We never really find out which. And he has a proposal for her.
This is Friedman.
Friedman. He has a proposal for her. He wants her to do something. He wants her to do something for him, or for the Jews, so to speak. And he takes her on this walk, and he takes her to Spinoza Street in Tel Aviv. I don't know how many of you followed the court case that went on, that actually recently finally ended in Israel's Supreme Court in June. But I'll take a minute to tell
it very, about Kafka.
Very quickly, yeah. So on Spinoza Street, in a building there, there was for many, many, many years the remains of all of what was left of Kafka's unpublished papers. And you ask yourself, how did they get to Tel Aviv? How did they get to this apartment building? So some of you might know that when Kafka died in 1924 in Prague, he wanted everything burned. He wrote to his friend Max Brod, he wanted all of his papers burned. Max Brod didn't burn them. And some years later, in 1939, on the last train out of Prague, as the Nazis were entering Prague, Max Brod stuffed all of Kafka's papers into the suitcase, eventually made it to Palestine. From Palestine, he started to publish the works that some of you may have read and may love, all of Kafka's stories and his novels. And then when Max Brod died, what was left of that suitcase of papers was passed down to his secretary, and when she died, to her daughters. Now, her last remaining daughter is now old, and what's left of those papers is in this house in Spinoza Street with like 30 cats. And of course, this makes Israel, the National Library of Israel, furious. They want these papers. Ava Hoff, the daughter, believes they're hers. For 8 years, this case goes on through the courts. I used to walk by that house in Spinoza Street. I spent a lot of time in Tel Aviv. And I would find myself thinking, like, is it Kafka who's imprisoned inside there in this really Kafkaesque way, you know? Or is it us out here on the other side of these bars and double mesh, because, you know, there's that sense of paranoia that you know, around the windows of her apartment. Is it us who's imprisoned from touching what we so desperately want, whatever might be left of Kafka that we don't know, you know, that some nugget of beautiful literature that we haven't yet read? And the more I thought about entrapment, the more I thought, of course, about its flip side, escape, because what was happening to my characters, Nicole and Epstein, is in some ways a kind of escape, right? So I started to think about escape, and I started to think about how this story that we know about Kafka is really a construct, like all stories of all of us are constructs. It's a construct of Max Brod, who wrote Kafka's biography, who edited all of his work. And that story is more or less as follows. It's like Kafka was a martyr. He died of all the things that he couldn't escape from, his tuberculosis, his overbearing father, all these things, the fact that he wasn't made for this world. But actually, I don't know how we can read Kafka without feeling fundamentally that this is somebody who escaped. Because, you know, 100 years later, we're still reading him, right? He still eludes us, and we still seek to understand him. And so I wanted to somehow, I mean, I'm interested in writing that alternate reality, the reality, to me, a very real reality of Kafka's escape. So at some point or other, Nicole, this character Nicole, gets embroiled in that story, in this kind of rewriting of the story of what really might have happened to Kafka.
I think that's one of the more brilliant parts of the book, is just making that alternative history as real as real history. I mean, you almost say, maybe this is actually right. You know,
right. So. Right. Without giving too much away, there a lot of people have finished this book and told me, I actually had to Google that about Kafka because I thought it was true. Is that true? Is that actually, you know? And I think that this is the wonderful thing. I mean, this is what this book is so pushing at its core, is the question. I mean, from this passage I just read about Nicole too, that question of what is real and what is unreal, and why do we so readily prioritize aspects of reality that we don't even question? We're told, well, this is reality, this is true, and that over there, that's fiction, that's unreal. This, Nicole, you up there, is that real, that story that you're writing in there, is that really you, or is that, you know? And the more I write, the more time I spend, you know, 15 years now writing novels, understanding that when you write, you are expanding your sense of self, right? Like if I write the story of an old man, or if you read a book about an old man, whether you're an old man or not, you are going to become him, right? You expand a little bit your sense of how to be, of who you are, and this act of empathy and bringing your emotions to and experiences to that. And we do that in literature, but then we come back out of literature, out of the book, out of our writing rooms into life, and we then go back to this very narrow idea of how much we can change the narrative of who we are, of ourselves, you know. And I think that idea of, you know, provoking the reader to say, well, you know, this is Nicole, is this you or is this not you? And of course, all kinds of surreal, quite surreal things happen to her, which beg, you know.
Right.
You know, I think it's an invitation to the reader to say, why not bring our sense of how much we can enlarge that story of ourselves, that story that goes back to, like, you know, our mother saying, like, you are like this and your brother's like this and your teachers give you reflections and your friend, and you have this one sense of this story of who you are because we so desperately need that coherence. But at some point the story gets too tight, right? It's too small, and we don't use that ability that we know we have in literature to open it, not enough.
I remember a philosophy professor in college, and he would talk to us about the true self, and that this is some strange concept in Western philosophy, that there's some true self, that everything else is, oh, we're in a, you know, bad mood or having a different day. And you don't really think of literature as challenging that notion of a true self, although there's certainly a tradition of it, but you really do that in this book, and that was something that you clearly sought to do.
I think you're right. It goes beyond just the sense of the self. I mean, so there's the one idea of how much can we accept that the self is a malleable narrative, right? There's that whole idea and argument in the book, but there's also that sense of the real, what we consider real, reality. And again, the more I would kind of go out of my writing room into the world, and I would say, okay, so the world we create in literature feels so authentically real, often feels more real than this world when we're in it, right? And we often go to literature to deliver us some sense of the truth of who we are. But then we come back and we're like, oh, but reality is really just this, you know, we're hemmed in by it. But the more I would think about that, the more I think about that, no, that's really not right. Like, you know, I don't know, all of the various fictions that we just agreed to believe are real, just for example, like, who didn't learn in eighth grade that, you know, these things are not actually solid in the world. Like, they're actually atoms and a lot
just
of empty space. And we, as a species, we need to believe they're solid because it benefits our survival. We need to, like, know that a rock is solid so we can pick it up and throw it or whatever it is that we need to do to survive. And yet we go on seeing them as solid, even though we know it's perception, you know. Or then on another level, like, just the idea, for example, that, like, all the paper in your wallet is worth something. like that's just a fiction, actually, that we collectively agree to believe in.
That explains Bitcoin. I don't know what that is.
That what?
I said that explains Bitcoin because right. I still don't know what that is.
But all of these. Once you begin to think about like reality, which we go about not questioning at all, we see that no, actually, it contains as many fictions as the fictional world, you know, and that sense we had back in childhood of life being much more expansive before we were rooted in conventional ways of looking at things that flattened, I think, our sense of that, you know, that it's not necessarily immaturity that caused us to see the world like that. It was an openness, and you know.
But for both Epstein and Nicole in the book, questioning, you know, the received tenets of their life, it's not easy. It's
yeah.
really challenging yeah. and hard, and they go through various kinds of trauma as they do that questioning. I mean, does that make some people turn away from the kind of questioning that you're talking about? And what sort of metamorphosis would you use in the book, going back to Kafka, do they both kind of go through over the
yeah.
course of the book?
Well, I think, of course, it's hard. I mean, we all know that it's so much more comfortable to live in a world of certainties, even when it's uncomfortable, like, and even when we feel that our lives are too tight, it's still, the stability is something that we really cling to. And I think that's just like the human mind and heart needs coherence, and it will stick to a sense of coherence at any cost. And it's uncomfortable to say, to turn toward the unknown or to dwell in a kind of uncertainty. But that's what these characters are turning toward. And that was very, very important to me to write about. I think it's at a certain point when I was starting out this novel, I found myself thinking a lot about how we live in a world where we so value information. We so value certainties, basically, factual, rational knowledge. It's so comforting to know we can lay our fingers on our computers and access Google, and all of the known world is accessible and known, you know, or so it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I thought about that obsession, which I think we've kind of made a religion out of to some degree, the more I would start to think, well, actually underlying that is a kind of anxiety. Because for thousands of years, there was room in the world for the unknown, and turning toward the unknown was ritualized in some sense. And when I talk about the unknown, I think now we think of the unknown as just like ignorance, you know, but I'm talking about something else, like the unknowable, that thing that you turn towards when you say, you know, there's so much that we don't understand about life, and it can fill you with awe and with wonder. That simple thing of, like, you know, looking out at the sky at night and really seeing it and thinking of how, you know, our place and all of that. And so the more I thought about that, the more I wanted to write a book that was about that turning, the turning away from the comfort and stability of the rational, known, set world towards something that is uncomfortable, but if we dwell in it for long enough, we arrive at, you know, we're filled with something else, and that I think allows for change, allows for growth.
But as a novelist, too, you have a terrific passage in the book about how a novel must necessarily deny a certain level of that chaos to be on the page and to be your creation. I mean, that's
yeah.
one of the central tenets of the book is the novel itself has to kind of, you can go toward that chaos, but ultimately you have to get something on the page and something has to happen
right.
in order for it to be a book that we can all read.
Well, so that's one of the things that kind of haunts Nicole. So her job is narrative, right? Telling stories and novels. And what she says at some point about narrative is that, you know, the thing about it is it needs to order the world into story. But the one thing that narrative can't reflect is chaos, is formlessness. You know, it just can't hold that.
Mm.
And then it has to betray that truth, because chaos is some part of all of our lives. And there is that, I mean, we all know that feeling of just like when things happen to us, we need to just like, We need to rationalize it into a story to understand it. Again, I think this is just the human brain. We absolutely fundamentally need narrative. But can we at least admit that we are using narratives very often and that they can be altered, they can be changed? And I think it's that she, Nicole, has this long to somehow write a novel that is both narrative but also can hold that authentic truth, which is the disorder.
The chaos. Somewhere in the book you say that Israel eludes answers, I think is a phrase, or something like that, and both Epstein and Nicole are in Israel trying to understand what's happening to them as they go through this part of their lives, as they both, you know, head into the desert in various ways. What is it about Israel itself that made that the right setting for people dealing with chaos, or sort of wanting chaos after the order that they've experienced so far in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've been going to Israel all of my life, and it's a place that anyone who's been there even once will have felt this within an hour of being there. It is urgently alive because it's engaged with the question of who are we? What will we be? This is a place that, in a sense, was projected into existence and, you know, has now, not quite 70 years, has had to kind of invent itself out of nothing, invent a national character and a culture and a society. And you feel there the violence, the complication, the tenderness, the beauty, the liveness of that constant daily existential creation. And I think you feel it particularly in the last 15 years in Tel Aviv, because Tel Aviv has kind of emerged as a counterculture to mainstream Israel. And it's really in Tel Aviv where, you know, for the first time, it's no longer a diasporic European Ashkenazi idea of, you know, here's what Israel will be. In Tel Aviv, you have Israelis, you know, creating culture, food, humor, literature, music, that is a reflection not of that European diasporic idea, but of a Jewish existence in an Arabic context, you know, and they've really hijacked the narrative of who they are, what they're going to be. So it's very live in that sense, and it made perfect sense to me to send these searching characters who are engaged in that kind of a self-expansion there. Also because, of course, you know, it is a place that has a long tradition of revelation, right?
Could say that. Yeah. And that contrast with America, and we talked about one more reading from the book that I think gets to the differences between and sort of what these, at least largely Americans, are coming from and that experience that they have in Israel. Do you want to set that up a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, and I think that is, you know, this increasing confusion that we have as Americans or just Jews in diaspora when we go to Israel. Is this ours? Is this not ours? Is this an extension of us? Is this no longer? Is this a reflection of us? Are we in the realm of the consequences of this place? Are we passionate about it? Are we disturbed by it? All of that sort of conflicting feelings. So at some point in the book, Epstein has left that Tel Aviv Hilton where he has also checked in, and he's decided to stay in Israel, and he's looking for an apartment, and a real estate agent decides, he hires a real estate agent to take him around to find a place. So here's a little bit about that. This is the real estate agent. He knew better than to trust the first flush of American enthusiasm. Knew how they came and for a week fell in love with the urgency and the argument and the warmth, with the way everyone sits in the cafes and talks and gets into each other's lives, the way that even if on the outside Israel is obsessed with borders, on the inside it lives without boundaries. How there's no disease of loneliness here, and every taxi driver is a prophet, and every salesman at the shuk will tell you the story of his brother and his wife, and the next thing you know, the guy behind you in line is chiming in, and soon enough the crummy quality of the towels doesn't matter anymore, because the stories and the mess and the craziness, all of that life, are so much more essential. They come to Tel Aviv and find it so sexy, the sea and the strength, the nearness to violence and the hunger for life, and how even if Israelis are living in an existential crisis all the time and sense their country is lost, at least they live in a world where everything still matters and is worth fighting for. Most of all, they fall in love with how they feel here. This is where we come from, they think, as they duck through the tunnels under the Western Wall, slink through the tunnels dug by Bar Kokhba, scale Masada, stand in Levantine sunlight, hike the Judean, camp in the Negev, come to the Kinneret, where the children that could have been their own grow up wild and barefoot and related to the past mostly through acts of discontinuity. It's this that we didn't know we missed.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author Nicole Krauss, whose new novel is Forest Dark. She's joined in conversation by Judson True. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But the agent knew well that after a week or two, they start to feel differently, these Americans. The strength starts to stink of aggression, and the directness becomes pushy. It begins to grate how Israelis don't have any manners, how they have no respect for personal space, no respect for anything, and doesn't anyone do anything in Tel Aviv aside from sit around talking and going to the beach? The city really is a shithole, isn't it? Everything that isn't new is falling apart. The whole place smells of cat piss, there's a sewage problem right under the window, and no one can come for a week. And actually, Israelis are impossible to deal with. So stubborn and intractable, so frustratingly immune to logic, so damn rude, and it turns out most of them don't care for anything Jewish. Their grandparents and parents ran away from it as fast as they could, and the ones that do care, they're over the top, those settlers, totally out of their minds, and frankly, the whole country is a bunch of Arab-hating racists. And just so, in the nick of time, before they put down the deposit on a two-bedroom, the new glass high-rise going up over Neve Tzedek, it's back in the cab to the airport with their suitcases fragrant with za'atar and laden with silver Judaica from Hatzrafim and their Lexus keys newly hung on a Hamsa.
There you go. Still dark but more amusing parts of the book is when you explicitly reject the idea that you're doing PR for, Jewish thought or Jewish novelists or anything like that. But clearly you're very much, you're in dialogue with the great traditions of Jewish literature in this mm-hmm. book. And that was clearly important to you to do that. Is that something that you consciously, sought out to do in particular in this book? It's true of your other books as well, especially History of Love. But
yeah, I am very much so. I mean, I know, again, one of those early feelings I had before writing this book was somehow like, I want to write a novel that somehow has like 3,000 years of Jewish history. Like, how can I do that? But contemporary too. But I think somehow one of the things I found myself thinking a lot about are the ways in which those stories that we grow up with, and I mean, you don't have to be Jewish to grow up with the stories from the Old Testament, or even if you think about, the stories of Greek mythology or mm-hmm. Norse mythology, whatever your stories were that you grew up with, and in our case, they were Old Testament stories. They're so beautiful and they're so moving. And I mean, I watch my children fall in love with them. Their eyes, shine at those stories. You read them over and over and over again. But at the same time, there's this other side of it, which is like this flip side of the ways in which there's only, once you write that story of Abraham or Moses or David and you tell it for 2,000 years, there's only one way to be Abraham or Moses or David. And we keep naming our kids Abraham, Moses, and David after it all was Abraham. And so these over and over again, generation after generation, we are inscribing ourselves and our children in this convention of how to be. This is what courage looks like. This is what love looks like. This is what war. This is what worship. This is what God looks like. And yet, behind all of that is this other feeling that you can't deny, which is it could have been a different way. We bind and bind and bind ourselves to these stories, and we feel the good in it. We feel the good of being part of this long line of history. But on the other hand, there's something in us undeniable, that also just wants to be free, that wants to grow in some other direction, if you know what I mean. And there's this moment in the book where Friedman takes Nicole aside and they're talking, and he says to her, you know, why do you think that there's two stories of creation in Genesis? Like, don't you think that's a little bit strange? Like, you start Genesis and there's two stories of the creation of the world in one, you know, book. What do you think the editors, the redactors, were trying to say? And his theory is that, you know, it's kind of blasphemous, but it's that they were trying to say something very subtle about that when God created the world, he created light, he created dark, but he created this third thing too, which is regret. And the regret is that the world wasn't created in another way. So once you do it one way, once you create this finite world one way, or once you start a novel and you write, you know, one character, or you write the tone one way, you've given up all that infinity of what also was possible. And I think that regret is like deep in us as human beings. Like, we know it could also have been this other way, whether it's in the story of like 3,000 years of history, or whether it's in the story of our own life. Like, if I had taken that left when I was 18 years old, I wouldn't, you know, I would have, this and that would have happened, and yet I went right, and all these other things happened. But that left turn goes on reverberating in some echo of some shadow life. You know?
Sometimes I think about people who read are people who think a lot, and who write, obviously, are people who think a lot about those alternate mm-hmm. paths that we could have been down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think... But I think that, again, it's, you know, they enrich us. I don't, when I say regret, I don't think of it as something that therefore we should bury. You know what I mean? I think that to allow in those echoes of other existence, it gives us more dimension. It gives more dimension to who we know we are. And also, I think it helps us when we try to look at who the other is. You know, and this is something that I feel like we're dealing with constantly politically now, all the time. You know, it's in a world where we're so sure, we're so certain all the time, we're so anxious about not being certain. When we look at the other, the political other, you know, in Israel, whether it's the Palestinians, or I was just in Ireland now for this book, the Irish and the English, mm-hmm. or whether it's being American and thinking about refugees and immigrants who are coming here from Muslim countries, it's so easy to just, you know, go to the thing of like the other is like this thing we don't want to, you know, we know already, you know what I mean, and we don't really want to let the news of the other in, but to simply face it and say, I don't know that existence. I want to, you know, let the news of that come in to me. We know that we'll be changed by it, and we just don't know how. And so I think that's that sense of agreeing to let in more dimension, more news, more worlds. It's important.
So you definitely fall on the side of that literature creates empathy. It can't be a coincidence that we have a president right now who what is it? He gets rid of two books for every one book he gets, and then the previous president who was a writer and a reader and a real thinker.
I think what I will say about that is that I don't know anyone who's a reader who doesn't know quite quickly how to get to that root of empathy. It is what literature teaches us, just in that simple, bare fact of only in a book. I can't think of any place else in the world where you have this immediate root into another person's existence. Like, this is what it feels like to be something other, an old man, or to live in the 19th century, or to be a child, or whatever it is that you're not. You suddenly can step into that, and that teaches you just in your, literally in your brain, in the fretwork of your brain, it inscribes this experience of putting yourself into the other and being able to imagine that. And that empathy just becomes second nature, I think, to readers. So I don't think it's an accident, you know, that the personalities of two, you know, a reader and a non-reader, that we see that difference.
So we should make sure that we find out who the next set of candidates, what they're reading. We should make sure we subject them to some literary questionnaires.
We should make sure they can.
Well, I want to go ahead and thank you very much for being here with us at the JCC tonight as we turn it over to the audience. Thank you, Nicole. It's amazing to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about your process for when you first think of a character? I've read a lot of your other books, not this one yet, but you just have really vivid characters, and they're all very different. So just curious what, you know, how you think of them or how you form them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, wandering around looking for the right characters before I start my book. So sometimes it's, like, some years of just, like, writing things that don't end up being the novel. And that thing you're talking about, which is finding a character that feels urgent enough that I want to live with them and follow them over the course of the next years, is not easy to find. And usually it's something that will surprise me. I'll be working on something, and there'll be a moment in which the mortal breath is just blown into the character, and he or she comes just absolutely alive on the page in such a way that I know that it's no longer me who's keeping them alive. Do you know, they just have their own steam and momentum. And like with Epstein, it was really early on. I had this idea of somebody disappearing in the desert. I had some sense of his character, and I think like there was that moment when I wrote like "Death is too small for him" or something like that, where it's just like, oh wait, I suddenly had this sense of exactly who he was. But I never know enough about them that there'd be no reason to write the book. You know what I mean? If it's somebody that I've already figured out and understand, then there'd be no point in writing. It has to be somebody who has enough mystery to him or her that I want to understand, and I want to understand where that empathy I feel for them comes from and where it will take me.
And you don't just outline your books and then write to where you want to go. You let the writing carry you along.
I thought of this as I was flying to the West Coast from New York. I was reading a book of essays by Oliver Sacks that's coming out in a couple of months, and he has this essay about Darwin, and I thought, oh God, this will be a great way finally to explain this. It's the difference of how I write novels is the difference between like a divine plan and natural selection. You know? It's like, I don't have a divine plan ever. There's no divine, I don't execute anything, I don't have notes, I don't have blueprint. It's just like pursuing accidents, you know, an accident happens in the page and suddenly that gives birth to something else and that becomes something else. But I think therefore, it's true to life. It's authentic to me, at least, on the page, because I'm discovering it in the same pace as the reader is.
Hi. So this is going back to one of the last things that you were talking about, but I'm wondering if you can think of how or when you came to this realization of this regret for the path that wasn't chosen, and that expands your sense of empathy, it expands your sense of self, it like you were saying, it almost helps you connect with the other, or erases this idea of the other.
For me, that goes like back to the very beginning, and it goes back to the beginning because I think just sort of family history. I mean, my grandparents all came from Europe. Their lives were all disjointed and fractured because of the war. And so for as long as I was alive, there was always this other or this regret of this, you know, this different life that could have unfolded had that not happened. But had that not happened, I wouldn't have existed too, right? Because all my grandparents sort of were exploded out into the geography of the world. They met each other in England, two of them in Palestine, and you know, and all of those sort of things happened, and then I came to exist because of that sort of accident and that regret of, you know, of that history. So I think I've always just natively, since I was a child, had, I think, what almost you would call like a nostalgia for something lost, whatever it was. And I don't think it's an accident that my first novel was about a man who loses his memory, because it was almost like a cure, an immediate cure to that nostalgia that was so burdensome. But the more I thought about that, you know, excising of memory, the more obvious it became to me that I was actually writing about empathy, that empathy comes from, you know, that memory that we have of whatever we are rooted in or whatever we are yearning for that we can then use to relate to the other. So I think that's it's a lifelong atmosphere for me. I don't think I'm the only one. I don't think you need to have grandparents, you know, who survived the war to feel that way. I think very many of us come into the world with that sense of that accident of our existence and all the other possibilities that our parents and grandparents might have had that are tributaries into our life still.
I was just curious about your concept behind the title. I know you said that one of the characters decides to plant a forest in the name, like in memory of his parents. I was curious about your concept behind that.
Yeah. So the novel is filled with forests, and I think of the forest as the place in opposition to the city, which is like the reflection of human order. The forest traditionally has always been the place in our human imagination where it's outside of the law, right? Where mystery happens, where the unknown is, that is sort of beyond rational reason. There's a moment in the book where Nicole talks about Descartes. You know, Descartes, whom all of our notions of the rational individual kind of gently rest. Descartes wrote about finding a straight path out of the forest. And Nicole says, whenever I read that, I just want to get lost in the forest, you know? She says, I frankly hate Descartes. So there's all this stuff about forests. But at the end, when I finish this book, so the title is taken from the opening lines of Dante's Inferno. There's a little author's note when you get to the very end of the book. And those lines are, midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. But the funny thing is that I didn't want to call the... That wasn't my first idea for the book. My first idea for the book was to call it, I mentioned this word before, Gilgul, right? So Gilgul has all kinds of other meanings in the book, but in Hebrew it means a cycle or a wheel or the transmigration of the soul. So I told my publisher, I'd like to call this book Gilgul. And they're like, no, you can't call it that, you know. That's a Hebrew word, and this is an American book. And also, that sounds like a dragon from the Middle Ages. We actually had this whole meeting, and I said, I respect your judgment, but I'm telling you, this is a word we need. We need this word Gilgul in the language, and it's just like, who knew what a golem was until Isaac Bashevis Singer wrote the story of a golem, and then the golem came into the language. And I promise you, if we can call this book Gilgul, like in 3 months there'll be an article in Vanity Fair, and it'll be like Trump's Gilgul. Like we need, really, really, and they just sort of looked at me like, mm-hmm. So let us know when you find another title. And then, like a month before this book came out, my friend who had been privy to this whole argument sent me this YouTube clip, and I opened it up. And it was a clip from Fargo, the television show. And these two characters are sitting at the bar, and one of them says, you know what this is? This is my Gilgul. And then the other one says, you're what? And he says, it's a Hebrew word for a cycle or a wheel or the transmigration of the soul. Oh. And I was just like, you know, it wanted to come. It could have been me. It could have been me that brought it into the language. But instead, it's Fargo. And the book is called Forest Dark.
It is a chapter, though. Gilgul is a chapter. Thank you very much, Nicole Kraus, for coming to the JCC tonight. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Nicole Kraus, whose new novel is Forest Dark. She was joined in conversation by Judson True. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.